waking to find herself cemented. She met the tech's gaze. He had eyes of an uncertain color, maybe green, though in this light it was hard to pin down. She shot a questioning look at him. After a furtive look around the room, he leaned close, stretching over her to unlatch her left hand, and in the barest whisper, he said, "Remember me, goddess. Remember my service to you." "Goddess?" Dekka said nothing. She gave the most minimal nod, then stared blankly at the ceiling, faking the drug-induced coma she knew all too well. Female techs maneuvered her into a wheelchair. She sagged convincingly, like a big sack of potatoes. They pushed her down the hall to a room with a deep clawfoot tub, like something from Restoration Hardware. They began stripping off her flimsy hospital gown and socks, chatting among themselves as if she wasn't even there. They hauled her by main force to the tub and settled her into warm water. It was delicious on her skin, so sensual that for a moment she hesitated to disrupt the animal pleasure of warm water, but only for a moment. She had no time to experiment with her new power, but she'd had long experience of reaching that part of her mind. She hoped she wouldn't kill anyone this time. She reminded herself to take care, to try not to kill anyone. They were just government employees, after all, just techs and nurses. No different, really, from the three she'd accidentally slain during her first display of power. She pictured the power, imagined it, tried to define it, to find a way to focus it. Where to strike? How? The room had tile walls and no window, no way to know for sure which direction to take. So Dekka picked the largest expanse of wall, and she let her mind go where it had rarely gone since the days of the phase. The change began. Dekka felt her skin crawling, sliding over her bones, fur sprouting from flesh, hair moving of its own accord. It was eerie, not painful, but deeply disturbing. She looked at her hands as five black fingers melted together to make four. This time, she forced herself to pay attention, to observe. Not four fingers, really four full length and one that shrank and rotated toward her palm. Cat paws, that's what they reminded her of, these hands, though with longer fingers and no... But wait, did she have claws? "What the..." one of the techs yelled suddenly. The others turned to the tub, gaped, then retreated in a hurry. There was a red panic button on the wall, and one of the techs reached for it. "Stand back," Dekka said in a voice that was not her own. She sat up in the tub, drew her legs back, and saw that they too were changed, fur-covered but still otherwise human, down to the human-shaped feet. No time to freak out, no time to stare or to run searching for a mirror. Dekka rose in a single effortless motion, held up her freed hands, furry palms out toward the wall, opened her mouth and screamed, then a second sound, less biological, as the world around her passed through that invisible blender. Grrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr all at once. The wall exploded outward in a storm of shredded tile, wallboard, wood, steel, pipe, and wire. And suddenly, she was looking at a large room full of office cubicles. A dozen faces covered in dust and debris stared open-mouthed at the space where a wall had once been, and where now stood a naked, damp, furry, snake-haired monster. "Run!" Decca yelled. "Run away!" They did. Something tugged at her, a hand on her shoulder. She spun, ready to do whatever she had to do, and found herself face to face with Ginger Green Eyes. "I thought you might want this." He handed her something rectangular, wrapped hastily in a plastic bag. Decca knew what it was. "Remember," he said. Decca nodded. "I owe you one, maybe even two." Decca raised her free hand, shrieked, and blew out the next wall. Now she was looking at a debris-strewn cafeteria, and finally, through the cafeteria windows, sunlight. She exploded that final exterior wall and ran toward daylight. She stopped on seeing a large, portly man lying quivering on the floor. "You," she snapped. "Give me your clothes. Now." By the time he had stripped off a dress shirt and slacks, and Decca had put them on, the guards came rushing, weapons leveled. Decca aimed at the scattered chairs and tables, exploded them into shreds, and without thinking, hurled the debris tornado at the guards. That last move was almost a flourish. A twist of her hands and a directed gaze. Oh, there are tricks still to be discovered in this body, in this power. Decca gazed with intense, almost physical longing at the outside, the weak sunlight, the wedge of blue sky. But the courtyard was filling with armed men, and Decca did not want to hurt them, so she spun around and ran up the corridor, moving now beyond any place she'd explored. Behind her came armed men and women, boots clattering on the floor tile, and now there were sirens everywhere and a loudspeaker announcing, "Condition yellow, condition yellow, this is not a drill," in a flat computer voice. Some part of Decca vaguely resented the idea that she was only a condition yellow. Surely there was a condition red, and surely she deserved that designation. Suddenly, she ran out of the corridor, which was just as well since she was terribly out of shape and feeling it, a reality not helped by days locked down and cemented. "Not as young as I used to be," she panted, hands on knees, doubled over with a stitch in her side. "Or else," she thought darkly, "this body, this morph, this bizarre, terrifying body that seemed to incorporate elements of Cat and Medusa, wasn't big on endurance." Behind her, the guards yelled, "Freeze! Freeze!" and rushed. Ahead, the corridor ended in what looked a lot like a bank safe's vault door. There was a control pad, but she didn't exactly have time to play around with guessing passwords. Time to test the limits of her powers. She shoved the precious wrapped rectangle into the back of her borrowed pants, raised her quasi-feline paws, and with a roar, the massive steel door began to peel apart, layer after layer of steel shreds, revealing more steel just behind, and the guards were yelling, "Halt, or we open fire!" in voices barely audible against Decca's howl. Decca tried what she had not yet attempted. As the steel shards came loose, she formed a cup with one of her hands, and the shards of steel formed obediently into a swirling ball, 2 or 3 feet across and growing by the second. The swirling ball of steel shrapnel spun, and Decca focused her thoughts on a simple thought. Hard, but not too hard. She sent the spinning shrapnel ball flying. It whirled away down the corridor, straight at the guards, who fired futilely into it and turned too late to flee. The steel-shredded uniforms gouged eye covers, cut exposed skin, lacerated exposed jaws and hands. Guards screamed, and Decca, feeling sick at the pain she had caused, turned back to ripping open the steel door. The last layer was coming apart, and a familiar male voice yelled, "I don't give a goddamn how hurt you are. Shoot! Shoot! Kill her! Take her down!" Bullets flew, but Decca had raised her left hand, and as the bullets neared, they fell, torn into smaller bits. The steel vault door collapsed, a hole big enough to step through formed, and Decca wasted zero time doing just that. She leaped through into a very, very different place. The familiar, prosaic corridors of the ranch, corridors that might as easily have belonged in any government office building, were not part of this vista. She stood now at the rail of a steel platform, high above a vast open space, carved from living rock. Parts of the dirt and rock walls were held in place by orange plastic webbing. At the corners of the cavern stood 3-story steel towers, 4 of them, each a fortress, with weapons, recognizable things like machine guns, and less recognizable things that still, by their positioning, by the number of uniforms on or near them, and merely by their dangerous look, could only be weapons as well. The towers were pierced by windows with glass so thick, the men behind them were distorted, and the light within shone a sickly green. There could be no question that these were guard towers, more massive and sophisticated versions of the guard towers at any maximum security prison. And there were prisoners. 2 tall cell blocks were cut into the rock walls, ziggurats of steel and bulletproof glass, 5 levels in some places, 4 in others. Each level was a tier of cells, their doors made of glass that in some places were further strengthened by lattices of thick titanium straps. The facility was obviously still under construction. At the far end of the yawning cavern, cranes and scaffolds festooned a third cell block. Sparks flew from welders' torches. The engines of huge earth movers roared. Low-built trucks slowly hauled great loads of steel, while an overhead conveyor belt trailed cables carrying funnels of wet concrete. Dekka did not want to go down there. She did not want to go down there at all. But when she looked back, she saw a startling sight. Guards dressed head to toe in bulky flame-retardant suits were advancing, spraying liquid fire ahead of them. Kill or run. And part of her mind thought, how many times have I faced that choice? How many lives had she already taken, in the before and in the now? How many was the right number to die for Dekka's freedom? She ran down the stairs, her feet slippery on the steps, so that she clattered, half sliding, down to the next landing. But her strange morphed body felt pain only distantly, and while this body might be low on endurance, it was strong as hell and quick, and Dekka rose instantly. Guards from below rushed up the stairs toward her. Flamethrowers behind, automatic weapons ahead. Just how much punishment will this body take? Dekka gathered herself up, sucked in a deep breath, muttered something that was either a prayer or a curse, and leaped over the railing into the void, 50 feet above the unforgiving packed earth ground below. As she jumped, she spun in midair, raised her hands, howled, and shredded the levels of stairs and catwalks and platforms as she fell, destroying everything below the flamers and everything above the gunmen, cutting each off. The shrapnel fell in a rain of steel, and it would cut and it would bruise, but Dekka hoped it would not kill. She hit the ground. Her legs buckled. Her spine was a single long stabbing pain. Yes, it seemed there were limits to her body's pain tolerance, but she rolled with the impact and lay winded, face down. She inventoried her body. Her legs could move, her arms could move, and to her amazement, when she stood up, her muscles lifted her effortlessly. Okay then, that's great. Now how the hell do I get out of here? There was an exit door directly below the now shaky platform, but if she shredded her way through that door, she'd likely bring the rest of the catwalk down on her head and kill the men still clinging precariously above. She turned the other direction and ran. Ran past parked earth movers, threaded her way through piled construction supplies, and dodged a truck whose driver saw her and promptly ran his vehicle into the base of the nearest guard tower. Dekka emerged from the construction mess, face to face with the lowest tier of cells. She stopped, staring in disbelief. On the other side of the glass was not the narrow jail cell she expected to see, but a room the size of a double-wide trailer. The sides of the room opened onto still more glass and steel-barred cells. This facility was far larger than she'd imagined. How many prisoners is Peaks holding? But that question was quickly replaced by another one. What in God's name is he doing? The room beyond the glass was dominated by a stainless steel table bolted to a stainless steel floor. Beneath that table hung a thicket of wires, blue, green, yellow, and red. And threaded through those wires was a maze of clear plastic tubes pulsing with fluids. Atop the table were 4 glass bell jars, and within each of the bell jars, a head. A human head. Bert! The bulletproof glass of the nearest cells starred from the rapid-fire machine gun coming from behind Dekka. Dekka dropped, turned, and saw a drone flying on 4 horizontal propellers, zooming toward her, gun blazing. She turned it to scrap metal in midair, but she could see the guns of the 2 nearest towers now pivoting toward her. Condition red. Condition red. This is not a drill. The loudspeakers blasted. Red. That's more like it. Dekka had begun to learn a valuable lesson. Regular people thought of walls as walls, but to Dekka, they could be doorways. So could bulletproof glass. She raised her hands and shredded the glass that came flying off in a shower of crystal shards, whirling around to form a tornado of random-shaped diamonds behind her. She leaped through the hole she'd made and into the chamber beyond, meaning to cut her way right through the far wall and the earth beyond and up into the sunlight. And then one of the heads opened its eyes. "Ah!" Dekka yelped. She stared in shock, so profound. It paralyzed. What she'd imagined was some bizarre morgue with decapitated heads mounted for study was quite a bit worse than that. The four heads, the heads without bodies, were alive. Alive and watching her, their eyes wide, their mouths moving soundlessly. But maybe not really soundlessly. Dekka spotted a handle in the side of the nearest bell jar, lifted the glass and hurled it aside, and now the mouth was no longer silent. In a wheezing but unmistakably human voice, the head said, "Don't hurt us."
Whoa.
No more eloquent words came.
"Don't hurt us,"
the voice repeated. And it was a child's voice, a child's voice, and Dekka saw a child's face, a child's head. All four heads belonged to young people. The youngest, maybe 10, the oldest, perhaps 16. Three yelling soundlessly beneath bell jars, the fourth crying, "I want to go home, I want to go home, don't hurt us, I want to go home."
"Who are you? Who are you?"
"I'm LaShawn Wilkins," the near head responded, voice tearful and terrified.
"What are you doing here?"
Dekka demanded, but before she could get an answer, a second drone came whizzing through the hole she'd made in the outer glass. It zoomed in, hesitated, as its controller searched for the target, and then leveled its machine gun right at Dekka's head. The drone spoke with the mechanically distorted voice of Tom Peaks.
"Dekka, stand down. I don't want to hurt you."
"What in God's name are you doing here?"
Dekka cried.
"Surviving," the drone with Peaks's voice said. "These four will form the vanguard of a cyborg force capable of taking on people like me,"
Dekka supplied.
"Simple choice, Dekka. You serve your country, or you are an enemy. Join us or die."
Why was he explaining? Then, Dekka saw his problem. The drone couldn't fire at her without hitting some of the decapitated heads. Yes, she thought, but it could still maneuver to get a different angle. He's stalling. There was a swoop from a steel door opening quickly at the far end of the room, a door large enough to drive a car through, and indeed, through the door came a vehicle unlike anything Dekka had ever seen. It had rubber tank treads rather than wheels, and lay wide and low to the ground, rising no more than 3 feet. A blank steel box with treads, but even as it pelted toward her, the front panel dimpled and a cannon barrel protruded. And yet, it too did not fire. It might not need to, for from one side of the robot vehicle now grew an articulated mechanical arm, and at the end of that arm was a whirling blade, like a table saw.
Someone's been watching Robot Wars on YouTube.
Dekka dropped to her knees, aimed her hands, and shredded the drone, which came apart as if it were made of confetti. The tracked vehicle zoomed to its left, trying to come around the table. Dekka crawled and then jumped up and dodged left, keeping the four heads between her and the tank. Now a voice came booming through the public address system, Tom Peaks sounding like Jehovah in a bad mood.
"Carl, kill her and I will free you."
There was a swoop sound once again, but smaller, nearer, and from the corner of her eye, Dekka saw that one of the massive glass cell doors was sliding open. From that cell emerged a nightmare creature. It had four legs, legs as thick as tree trunks. Its torso was vaguely human, as if the four legs had been grafted onto a white, hairless body that bulged with coiled muscle. The thing had two arms, each maybe 8 feet long, so long they would trail on the ground if the creature dropped them. The arms ended in claws that glittered with the dangerous hardness of titanium. The head was twice normal human size, slung forward on an elongated neck that seemed barely able to carry the weight. The creature's face. Ah, that's what stopped Dekka from instantly shredding it. For the face was undeniably human, twisted by a mouth bulging with dagger teeth and with small eyes that blazed red, but that were still unmistakably human.
Take her, Carl, now! Peek shouted from everywhere at once. The monster with the prosaic name of Carl rushed with supernatural speed. In half the blink of an eye, it was on her. Its massive arms coiled around her waist, pinning her arms to her side. And though this strange body of hers was strong, it was like a child in the grip of the creature. Its huge head, its glittering, mesmerizing mouth, was inches from her face, and it spoke.
Kill me,
it rasped. I can't breathe, she managed.
I will help you, but you must promise to end this. End me.
But I
swear. Swear by whatever is holy to you.
Dekka's head was swimming, her vision reddened, and she felt vast strength in the monster's arms, strength great enough to crush her, right here, right now, to end her life in a second's time.
I swear,
she managed through a strangled throat. The creature released its grip.
Tear those glass doors apart, free those prisoners, and follow me.
Dekka looked back at the glass walls forming cages. The nearest glass was starred, as if it had been battered from the inside. She couldn't see well through the glass. It was too thick. But she made out one person clearly enough. A very tall white boy. Dekka made a pushing motion with her hands.
Stand back, stand back!
The tall white kid backed away, and she hoped the others could not see she had done the same. Then she howled, and the thousands of pounds of hardened glass disintegrated into a bee swarm of fragments. Glass shards fell and piled up.
This way,
Carl yelled, and bounded toward the door the tank had come through, the tank that had now circumnavigated the table of heads and was sighting its weapon on Dekka. The monster shoved her ahead, and the tank opened a deafening cannon fire, 20-millimeter shells exploding, but all striking the back of the creature named Carl. Smoke rose from behind him, shrapnel cascaded and clattered everywhere, and Carl's body shook with the impact. Dekka ran for the door, into a tunnel carved into the rock, with only the floor paved smooth for the tank.
Keep going, Carl cried. It comes up through Tower 2. Go to the top. There's an emergency escape pod there. Show me!
Carl gripped her arm, with one irresistibly powerful claw, the titanium nails stopping just short of cutting her flesh.
My name is Carl Pullings. I'm from El Segundo. Find my mother. Tell her...
Not this.
Tell her Carl loves her. Come with me.
The massive head shook slowly.
You don't understand. They see me. The dark ones. The eyeless watchers. They're in my head. They hurt me. It's pain.
Carl screamed the last word.
Kill me. Kill me now, or I swear I'll kill you.
He released her arm and pushed her away. He was blocking the door. Cannon fire apparently having no effect as the tank emptied its magazine in futility.
I'll find your folks, Dekka said.
She squeezed his arm.
Thank you.
Dekka raised her hands, opened her mouth, and Carl flew apart into pieces of gore. Dekka fled in panic and in agony of the spirit, racing down the dimly lit tunnel with tears blurring her vision. Side tunnels opened to left and right, but she kept straight ahead, her mind shattered by what she had seen, what she had done. Straight and straight, and there, yes, the position was probably about right. A circular staircase rose, but it was too narrow, the steps too shallow for the creature she now was.
They see me. They're in my head.
And Dekka, too, saw them, sensed them, felt their amused gaze. Felt the brutal minds that seemed to reach into hers with tendrils like black smoke.
Back to normal,
Dekka ordered herself, and looked down to see her hands resuming their usual shape. Human once more, and free of the watchers, she propelled herself up the stairs, two steps at a time, stumbling, hauling herself up, running, gasping, reaching a door that was blessedly unlocked, and threw onto an open platform. She was atop one of the towers in the vast cavern. All around her, robotically controlled machine guns were trained on the main floor below, and something that looked way too much like a massive ray gun. No guards. And there, on the edge of the platform, hanging over the side, rested three pods the size of subway cars.
They were helpfully stenciled Escape Vehicle 2-1 through 2-3, and beside the front hatch was a big red button shaped like a mushroom. She slammed her hand down on the button, and the nearest hatch opened. She spilled inside, gaping at what might as well be a passenger jet, with five rows of seats, four to a row. She had entered from the side and rushed to the front, pushed her way into an unoccupied cockpit with front-facing window and three more buttons labeled from left to right, 1, 2, and 3. She hit them in sequence, 1, 2, 3, and a canned voice said, "Please clear the doorways. Please clear the doorways." Then, with a soft shush, the doors closed. The mechanical voice helpfully warned, "Please buckle in and prepare for launch." Launch? With unsettling speed, the escape pod tilted back, bringing the cockpit to face skyward, or at least toward the stalactite-festooned ceiling of the cave. Launch in 3 seconds. 2, 1. Dekka fought gravity and exhaustion and hauled herself into the sole seat in the cockpit just in time to be slammed down by a sudden acceleration. The vehicle shot straight up, straight toward the ceiling, straight toward what must at the very least be several feet of rock. But at the last second, the rock ceiling shimmered and disappeared. A hologram. The escape pod flew up, up, through the hologram, up through a short tunnel, burst through a glass dome like Willy Wonka's elevator, and flew on another 100 feet straight up, up into blue sky, up toward towering cumulus clouds. And then came the roar and shudder of rocket engines catching fire. The pod leveled with stomach-twisting speed and soared on stubby wings, zooming over the facility, arcing toward a wide, flat space of cleared ground at the edge of the fence. At the edge of, but still inside, the fence. Looking down, Dekka saw SUVs racing to the pre-programmed landing spot, and ahead armed men spilled from a small guardhouse, automatic weapons at the ready. She was sure the skin of the escape pod was not bulletproof, and they would blow her straight to hell before the slowing escape pod could land at its pre-programmed target. Time to change. Dekka shredded the windshield of the pod, cleared it away, and then tore up the ground between her and the guards, showering them with a hailstorm of dirt and debris. The escape pod landed gently, its only gentle move so far, and Dekka was out, leaping with the sure-footed agility of a cat. The fence ahead, and beyond it, the woods. But she was not fast enough or strong enough to run for long, certainly not fast enough to outrun the fit guards, let alone the SUVs racing to cut her off. And then she saw it at the edge of the parking lot, the dirty vinyl cover. She ran toward it like a burning woman running for water. She snatched off the cover, and in a single fluid bound was astride her motorcycle. "Chase this, assholes," Dekka said. She kicked the engine to life, popped the gear, and rocketed ahead, swerving dangerously. This body balanced differently from her own, and went straight for the nearest section of fence. Gunfire erupted behind her, and she crouched low, flat across her gas tank, twisting the throttle all the way open. She raised a hand and howled, and the double row of barbed wire-topped chain link became a shower of penny nails. Into the woods, between tall pine trees, tires bouncing over roots and ruts, fishtailing as she turned. She hit a glancing blow at a tree but kept her balance, and there was tarmac ahead. The road. Up onto the road she motored, loving the welcome smoothness, and the motorcycle passed 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, trees whipping past on both sides. The SUVs wouldn't catch her. The SUV had not been built that could keep pace with her Kawasaki. But in her rearview mirror, she spotted two drones closing the distance. Brrrt. Bullets pinged off the tarmac and ricocheted into the trees. Faster. At 100 miles an hour, the drones were no longer gaining. At 110, they fell back, machine guns sputtering futilely as she outdistanced them. Dekka racked her memory. How long was this road? Where did it come out? If she reached populated areas, would Peak still attack? 120, and Dekka was pressed low and flat on her gas tank, morphed paws gripping the handlebars, wanting to revert to her more easily balanced body, but knowing that if she skidded out at this speed, it would certainly kill her human form. A new sound, like the bike, but in a different pitch. She risked a glance. Nothing. risked a second glance, and spotted a helicopter gunship, dark, dangerously sleek, and bristling with missile pods. There would be people in that helicopter, a pilot at least, maybe more. Just government employees, not people deserving to die. But was there an alternative? Her bike was fast, but the gunship would have at least 50 miles an hour on her. Then, appearing ahead, the gate and the guardhouse. The helicopter fired. Dekka heard it, heard the explosive thrust of a rocket motor, hit the brakes while downshifting, and fought to control the bike as the missile overshot and exploded the ground before her. The bike rolled through a storm of smoke and debris, and Dekka was skidding on her side, the bike sliding away from her, skidding and then tumbling, and finally coming to a stop in a cloud of dust and pine needles. She rose, her body screaming with pain, raised her hands, no time for regrets, no time for second thoughts, saw the helicopter coming in slow to blow the smoke away with its rotor wash and get a clear shot. She had a glimpse of the pilot, a woman from what Dekka could see of the face below the helmet. And then, as Dekka wearily ready to destroy the helicopter, something white and shockingly quick tore from the woods. It leaped 50 feet, used a tall sapling as a sort of parkour launch pad, and flew through the air, claws, for it had claws, outstretched. The creature smashed into the side of the helicopter and seemed to lose its mind, ripping, tearing, bashing, as the helicopter went into a spin and the pilot leaped to what would surely be her death. And then, the helicopter, the creature, and anyone else aboard the doomed aircraft crashed to earth like a duck in hunting season. Dekka hobbled to her bike, lifted it far more easily than she could have ever managed with her own body, prayed, kicked the starter, finished the prayer with a heartfelt amen to the engineers at Kawasaki, and zoomed toward the gate, which she shredded and blasted through, off the facility grounds and through the trees, and then kept going at speed until she reached a town. She stopped in the parking lot of an In-N-Out, panting for breath as she resumed her normal form. She was shaking, her whole body, like she had fever chills. For what felt like an eternity, Dekka sat there on her bike, sat with the engine still throbbing, as she tried to put together the pieces of what she'd just seen. Living heads. A boy named LaShawn Wilkins, from who knew where. A monster named Carl Pullings, from El Segundo. A vast underground chamber of horrors with God only knew what other atrocities. And murder. Hers, of Carl. Hers, of the guards with the blanks. And others. One thing was clear. Tom Peaks had not waited for his ASO mother rock to be recovered before preparing the ranch and its chamber of horrors. The secret underground at the ranch must have taken years to build. In fact, 4 years, she guessed. DARPA had been preparing since the phase. DARPA hadn't been waiting around. They'd been conducting ruthless, horrific experiments that testified to great fear and great ambition. Peaks was a criminal, a madman. A madman serving a government that had lost all remnants of decency. A government that had simply torn up the Constitution and used fear to justify horrors that belonged in the darkest pages of history. Dekka knew she needed to get off the grid. She needed to avoid her home, her friends, anything Peaks and company might be able to track easily. Where should she go? Where should she point her bike? But of course, deep down, Dekka already knew where. She had made a promise to the man she killed. So, south. South to find Carl's mother. What do I tell her? How do I lie to her? Then she spotted the unusually tall blonde boy wearing nothing but a pair of stretched and baggy underwear. He saw her too, and with a laconic grin, stuck out his thumb. "Who the hell are you?" Dekka demanded. "I'm the guy who took out that helicopter, and I'd really like to get the hell out of here." "The pilot?" Dekka asked. The white boy shrugged. "Last I saw, she was limping away." Dekka closed her eyes in relief. "Look, I'll take you a few miles. After that, you're on your own." "Fair enough," said Armo. He swung a long leg over the bike and settled on the seat behind her,
more than doubling the passenger weight on the bike. He put his arms around her waist.
Careful, Decca snarled. I'm not into guys, and I'm not in a great mood for bullshit.
Thanks for telling me, Armo said, because sex was totally what I was thinking of right now.
You got a name?
I go by Armo.
Decca.
Where are we going, Decca?
Home, she said.
Decca turned her bike south, south along the Pacific Coast Highway, which would eventually take her to Carl's mother in El Segundo. But first, it would take her to Perdido Beach.
Part 2. Hero, Villain, Monster. Interstice.
Tweets from Justin Devere Art. I am person from Golden Gate and LaGuardia. Terribly sorry for loss of life. I am unable to control creature called hashtag nightmare. 1 of 2. Given alien substance by government, not my fault. Hashtag nightmare is result. Trying to gain control of it. Pray for me. Justin Devere. 2 of 2.
Instagram.
My name is Justin Devere. I'm an artist. I was given a substance originally from the Perdido Beach anomaly by people with the U.S. government. They lied to me and used me. The result is the monster nightmare. I have no control over Nightmare. He is a creature who is easily angered and very, very dangerous. I am terribly sorry for the destruction and chaos and loss of life Nightmare has caused. I ask that people leave me and my friend Aaron alone as I attempt to gain control over the beast. Attacks on us will only unleash Nightmare and more will die. Please, I beg the government that caused this to back off as we work tirelessly to control the danger. Justin Devere, a.k.a. Nightmare. Tweet from Cal Newswire. CHP issues BOLO for black female age 19 riding red motorcycle 101 South. Consider armed and extremely dangerous. Tweet from Conspiracy Watch. Secret Monterey area DARPA facility site, a.k.a. The Ranch, is ID'd as experimental site, scene of multiple fatalities, cause unknown. Hashtag expose DARPA. Tweet from News Uncensored. Hashtag nightmare, at Justin Devere Art, part of USG conspiracy to exploit PBA alien technology? Tweet from Glenn Beck. Hashtag nightmare, how many deaths before government admits truth that powers are loose in the world? Hashtag expose DARPA. Tweet from CNN BRK. White House denies rumor that alien mutagenic fragments are still reaching Earth. Tweet from BBC Breaking. MOD rushing troops to Islay after reports of destruction caused by monster. New Loch Ness monster hoax? Tweet from Washington Post. NTSB unable to reach preliminary conclusion re causes of LaGuardia plane crash. Cover-up alleged. NSA intercept a phone call between Shade Darby and Professor Martin Darby. Call begins. SD. Hi, Dad. It's me. MD. Oh, thank God. Where are you? Are you all right? SD. I'm okay, for now, anyway. Dad, I am so sorry. I never thought it would come back at you.
MD. Well, Shade, it was perfectly predictable, don't you think?
SD. Silence.
MD. I mean, if you're smart enough to have tricked us all and smart enough to have taken the ASO, you're smart enough to realize there'd be consequences.
SD. Yeah. MD. Sigh. Silence.
SD. I don't have anything good to say, Dad. I was just looking for a way to...
Inaudible.
Not a victim. I mean, the world is changing. Nothing is going to stop that. It'll be powers against powers. I don't want to be helpless. Waiting.
MD.
You're not making sense, Shade. Surely you know you're not making sense. You have to come back and give yourself up. You don't know the kind of people you're dealing with.
SD.
If they're so bad, then giving myself up seems like a bad idea. Who's not making sense now?
MD.
Fine, great debating point, Shade. Give yourself a gold star. But what do you plan to actually do?
Esty, I don't know yet. I have this power now. I mean, what's done is done. I am what I am now.
MD, sweetheart, they will catch you. If they catch you, it will be worse than if you surrender peaceably.
SD, I hear you.
MD, you hear me and you ignore me. Same as ever.
SD, Dad.
MD,
yes?
SD,
I miss Mom.
MD,
yeah?
Me too, kid. Me too. I try to do her job too, but I'm not her, I'm just me.
SD, you've been a great father.
MD, don't make that past tense, sweetheart. I am still your father. I will always be your father.
SD, and I'll always be your daughter, but things have changed now. Things have...
Look, I have to go. They'll be tracking this call. I have to hang up.
MD, Shade, don't...
Call ends.
Chapter 14. A Career Setback. There was, of course, only one reason for Tom Peaks to be summoned to the Pentagon. He was to be fired. Failure had a taste. At least for Tom Peaks, it was the flavor of scotch. He poured his third scotch, held the bottle up for inspection, and laughed mirthlessly. It was Lagavulin. From Islay, Scotland. He wondered if the distillery would survive what was being called, with a confusing lack of geographical accuracy, the Loch Ness Caterpillar.
Best enjoy it, he told himself. There may not be a next year for Islay Scotch.
Peaks took a sip, set the glass aside, and resumed packing his carry-on bag.
Do you know when you'll be back?
His wife asked, leaning out of the walk-in closet. Peaks shook his head. Nope. Probably just a quick overnight. Well, be sure and tell them you need some time off. The kids feel like they've barely seen you lately.
Well, they'll see a lot more of me when I'm unemployed, Peaks thought.
He was not overly worried about finding another job. He'd made lots of contacts during his time with HSTF-66. There was a man who ran a security company, and a woman who was vice president of a major pharmaceutical, who had both tried to recruit him at various times. But what kind of jobs would those be? Organizing security details for spoiled rock stars and self-important billionaires? Or running the in-house security for some big pharma outpost?
Maybe I'll just watch TV and stay drunk for a week. Or a month. Or whatever.
He grabbed his bag, kissed his wife on the cheek, stopped by each of his two daughters' rooms to tell them he was heading out of town, and then he was taken by staff car and helicopter to Travis Air Force Base. There, he was ushered aboard one of HSTF-66's small fleet of passenger jets, popped an Ambien, and slept till Andrews Air Force Base, where he was picked up by a Pentagon staff car. His appointment was for 9 a.m., which was not a good sign, since it was neither a breakfast nor a lunch meeting. 9 a.m., early, no doubt, so that the Undersecretary of Defense, Letitia Pope, could get the distasteful part of her day over with early. Somewhat to Peaks' surprise, Pope did not keep him cooling his heels in her outer office. He was shown in promptly at 9. The Undersecretary had a pleasant office in the E-ring of the Pentagon, the outer ring where VIPs got windows looking out over parking lots. Peaks glanced at her ego wall, pictures of Letitia Pope with the Secretary of Defense, the President, the ex-President, the King of Jordan, various NATO counterparts, and of course, her degree from Princeton. Pope was middle-aged, with bottle blonde hair formed into a hair-sprayed helmet. She wore a tweed business suit that gave her a vaguely corporate air.
Tom, how are you?
Pope asked, extending her hand.
How was your flight?
Fine, fine, he lied, and took the seat she indicated on the couch in a small sitting area. Coffee was carried in on a silver tray by an enlisted man.
Well, Tom, Pope said, sounding regretful, Things are not going well.
Ma'am, we've had some difficulties, he acknowledged.
Pope raised a skeptical eyebrow at his mild choice of words.
But our core research is going well, Peaks added. Very well. Despite a destroyed airliner and a destroyed Golden Gate Bridge.
As I said. Difficulties.
And 9 dead at the ranch.
Peaks nodded. He was not surprised by the negativity. He had excuses, reasons, explanations, but the Pentagon had never been a big fan of explanations for failure.
Pope looked at him searchingly, as if making up her mind about him.
Give me the short overview on the research.
Peaks nodded again. Yes, ma'am. Well, as you know, we are working on several solutions concurrently. Broadly, there are 3 avenues: robots, cyborgs, and biologicals. The robot technology is performing nominally in tests. The cyborgs show great promise, though we are having technical issues with the head-to-computer interface, and we have proof of concept with the biological approach, though we did lose Carl, and your most hopeful biological test subject refused to cooperate and escaped doing, what, $10 million in damage? And at least one other escaped at the same time. Have you located them?
Not yet, Peak said stiffly. We can't really use law enforcement assets to their fullest, since of necessity this would be a shoot-on-site situation.
Cops don't do shoot-on-site, but California Highway Patrol has a bolo out for her, and once they or one of our surveillance assets locates her, we have a go team in a high state of readiness.
The door opened behind Peaks, and Pope stood for the Secretary of Defense herself, Janet Oberlin. Oberlin lacked Pope's minimal approachability. She was gray, hatchet-faced, chilly, and in Peaks's view, not up to the job, like most people in this government.
Madam Secretary, he said, and offered her his hand.
She looked at him, then at the hand, which she considered for a long moment before shaking.
Go ahead, Miss Pope,
Secretary of Defense Oberlin said.
Don't let me interrupt.
She sat equidistant from Peaks and Pope in the larger of the 2 armchairs.
I was just saying that we have a rapid response go team ready to deploy as soon as we locate Deca Talent and Aristotle Adamo.
And what about ASO-3, the Iowa Rock?
Peaks shrugged.
We know who had it, and we have a bolo out for that girl as well. Shay Darby, her name is. And we are preparing to move her father, Professor Martin Darby, to the ranch.
You're grabbing a Northwestern University professor,
Oberlin demanded. And too late, Peaks recalled that she was a graduate of that college.
For use if we can't reason with his daughter.
Oberlin rose to her feet.
Do you have any idea how that looks if it ever gets out?
Why should it get out? Peaks asked. And he allowed just the hint of a threat in his tone. Not enough to get him arrested right then and there, just enough to remind them that he, Tom Peaks, had all the secrets, and people with dangerous secrets needed to be treated fairly, carefully, respectfully. Neither Pope nor Oberlin answered, but rather than feeling vindicated, Peaks could see by their hard looks that he was finished. Still, he was employed at the moment, and he would continue to do his best.
There again, Peaks explained, there's the problem that law enforcement can only take things so far. We could ask them to arrest this Shay Darby person, but to what end? The young woman in question has powers that would make it all but impossible for her to be arrested.
And do we have any notion of where that person is now? Peaks met her eye and tried to conceal his impatience. Why were they making him jump through hoops? If he was to be fired, he'd rather get it over with.
We have some sense that they are moving west. We think they're stealing cars, switching plates, stealing smartphones as well.
No one's catching them stealing cars? The girl's power involves speed. She can move faster than the human eye can see.
Oberlin shook her head and looked disgusted.
Jesus, what a cock-up. We've lost control of ASO2 and 3 and 4. We have the Mother Rock, Peaks interrupted. Or will, as soon as the ship docks in L.A.
Swell, Pope said dryly.
But we've also got this nightmare person killing citizens left and right. We've got your experiment, the Dookie person, whatever her name is. Silly name, the girl from the PBA. And this speed freak girl, and the kid who went berserk. That's four supers running around loose here in the homeland.
Yes, Peek said tightly. And none of your countermeasures is ready.
We are ready to begin testing additional cyborgs.
That's where you stick a human head on a robot body? Oberlin asked.
Peeks winced. In effect, yes, though it's more complicated. Then Oberlin waved that off.
What you have ready right now, today, is Bupkis. Am I right?
There are the rapid response...
No, the SecDef said. I remember the briefings, Mr. Peeks. I remember being in a conference room almost 4 years ago, watching your PowerPoint and you telling us that conventional means would be useless against people with enhanced abilities.
Not useless, Peeks said. Just
limited.
Justin DeVere, the one who calls himself Nightmare, is not fast. He moves at normal speeds, and we are confident that we could take him down. Deca Talent as well, and the Adamo kid. But not the Chicago girl. As you know, we've studied powers. Super speed presents a very tough challenge. The girl in the PBA who called herself the Breeze moved at just under the speed of sound in short bursts, or could travel distances at something like 200 miles an hour. We think Shade Darby is faster, maybe quite a bit faster, and she appears to form some kind of protective armor over a streamlined shape. It's a physical impossibility to aim a gun at her. She's effectively invisible when she's moving.
So how do you stop her?
We have to trap her, Peek said. We have to trick her into a trap.
He almost added, problem is, we don't know how to do that, but stifled the outburst of honesty. Pope lifted some papers from the coffee table between them and peered sidelong at one.
This wasn't strictly your problem, but we have fresh confirmation that the Hakanis have ASO4.
As you said, that was not my operation. That was run by CIA, and the Adamo person was Colonel DeMarco's project, undertaken without...
That's General DeMarco now, Oberlin said.
The last flicker of hope in Peeks's head was drowned.
Do you have any idea how dangerous it is to have terrorists with enhanced powers?
Oberlin said, sounding as if she were giving a speech.
We are tasked with the job of keeping the American people safe, and so long as I hold this position, we will keep them safe.
I believe I do understand the dangers, Peeks snapped.
She was playing with him, like a cat with a mouse. Silence fell. Peeks could feel, rather than see, the looks being exchanged between Pope and Oberlin. A decision had been reached, and he could do nothing but wait.
Oberlin rose abruptly, motioning for Peeks to keep his seat.
I have a meeting with POTUS. I leave it to you, Miss Pope. Good day.
Her assistant leaped to open the door, and she was gone. Peeks turned back to Undersecretary Pope, assuming that he was about to hear the final words of dismissal. And yet, despite everything, every expectation, he was still stunned when it came.
Tom, we've asked you to do an impossible job, Pope said with a sigh. You've done tremendous work, but we feel it's time to make some changes in the leadership of HSTF-66 and of the ranch.
Peeks felt as if his whole body was tingling, like a mild electric current was going through him. He'd never been fired before. He didn't know the proper etiquette. He didn't know what to do with his hands or what expression to plaster on his face.
We want you to take the next week, Tom, and ease the path for General DeMarco. She'll be taking over as overall director, which will free you up to focus on some aspects of your continuing research.
So that was it. They wanted to keep him on as a glorified project manager,
a bureaucrat running the research program at the ranch, but reporting to his former subordinate, the former colonel and now Brigadier General Gwendolyn DeMarco. DeMarco was what was known as a comer, an officer with a great future marked out for her. She was the first woman general with substantial combat experience. She had a double PhD in anthropology and engineering, and was a star of the War College, third in her West Point class. Absolutely no one would be surprised if General DeMarco ended up as Army Chief of Staff, perhaps even Chairman of the Joint Chiefs someday. She'll march in and take credit for all my work. "This is a mistake," Peaks blurted. "This is a big mistake, pulling me out at this critical time. DeMarco has already screwed up. She tried to control the morphing process. And General DeMarco," Pope said acidly, "she's not going to know what's going on. It will take her weeks to get up to speed, and her judgment..." His rush of words petered out when he saw the set expression on Pope's face. "Time will be lost," he finished lamely. "Time we don't have. The general will be at the ranch to assume command tomorrow at 1400 hours. I'd like you to fly back immediately and begin preparing staff for the transition." Time stopped for Tom Peaks. It had happened. He had been fired, or at least demoted, which was the same thing, really. This supercilious pencil pusher and her icy bitch of a boss had conspired to destroy his career and advance the career of, surprise, surprise, another woman. Peaks had never thought of himself as any sort of sexist, but it was becoming clear to him now that there was a good old girls' network working against him. In fact, when he thought of it, most of his problems were because of women. Deca Talent, Shade Darby, even that silly little social climber, Erin O'Day with Nightmare, now Pope and Oberlin and DeMarco. Peaks could barely master his emotions as he left the office, turned the wrong way in the corridor, corrected himself, and walked as fast as he could toward the distant exit. On the private jet back to California, he ordered a scotch from the cabin attendant. Not an Isla product. Drank it too quickly, and ordered a second to savor. As he read yet again through the psychological profiles. Justin DeVere, a talented young artist, utterly amoral, a complete narcissist. Deca Talent, a seemingly average, underperforming young woman, suffering from but coping surprisingly well with post-traumatic stress disorder and bouts of depression. And Shade Darby, the one with the thinnest record, the sketchiest profile. Good grades, great test scores, impressive IQ. A young woman sufficiently determined and sufficiently bold to manipulate her father's data and pull off a heist under the nose of the entire security apparatus of the United States. She was the one responsible. Shade Darby. It was her theft of the rock that caused him to rush Deca's introduction to the role he had planned for her. It was her theft of the rock that first got the wind up Pope's skirts. A former Secretary of Defense had once talked about how there were no knowns, the things we know that we know, like the sky is blue and the sun rises in the east. Then there were known unknowns, like what is the cure for cancer? But there were also unknown unknowns, and these were the most dangerous, things we don't know we don't know. The things that came out of the blue, the things you didn't even know you had to prepare for. Like a teenaged girl stealing some of the rock, and using it, and developing one of the most useful, dangerous, and hard to defend against superpowers. One little bitch of a high school girl. He ordered a third drink. What did it matter? He wasn't the one flying the plane. And there'd be a car and driver waiting for his ignominious ride back to the ranch. How should he make the announcement? How could he possibly frame it so it didn't look like a public humiliation? He still needed the paycheck, and if he was a good little boy, if he knuckled under properly to the great Generalissimo and the mighty bitch goddess of the Pentagon, they might let him stay on as chief of research. He should be able to stomach it, he told himself. It shouldn't matter, he told himself. Who cared if people snickered behind his back? He told himself. Or he could quit. just quit. He'd made plenty of friends in private industry, people who would love to have him and the knowledge he possessed, and who would pay twice, no, three times, no, 10 times what he was making working for DARPA. Non-disclosure agreements and non-compete agreements and, he reminded himself, the unfortunate fact that almost every single thing he knew was classified top secret and top secret sensitive compartmented information, he had nothing to sell, really. Nothing that wouldn't get him arrested and thrown into some supermax prison. The cabin attendant, smiling, leaned over him. Would you like another, sir? Or can I get you something to eat? Another, Peek said. Nothing to eat. But then, as the attendant walked away, he said, wait a sec, what do you have to eat? We have a cheese and fruit platter, sandwiches, and pastry for dessert. In fact, we have chocolate eclairs, which look delicious. The scotch. Then bring me an eclair, and have one yourself. He downed the drink in 2 gulps, knowing it was a drink, or possibly 2 drinks too far. Well, to hell with it. Desperate times. The most desperate ever, probably. The very nature of reality was changing. The underlying rules of the universe were being hacked. And those silly bitches thought they could deal with it. Without Tom Peaks? Desperate times. Desperate times call for desperate measures, Peaks muttered. He used his Swiss Army knife to slice the eclair open, exposing the creamy center. From his pocket, he drew out a steel screw-top tube, partly filled with gray dust. They'd given Decca Talent 1 ounce. The eclair held 3 ounces. Chapter 15. A Nice Talk. They were in their 3rd stolen car. Felony, felony, felony. They were using money taken from bank tellers who saw nothing but a vague blur and felt a gust of breeze. Felony. Federal felony, at that. And they were in possession of approximately 10 pounds of alien rock taken by virtue of hacking. Felony and felony, both federal. Malik was keeping track. And now, as they sat amid fast food trash and empty water bottles in a stolen Lexus SUV in a Target parking lot in Silverthorne, Colorado, they were engaging in yet another felony. Conspiracy. Attention will be mostly on this nightmare person, Malik said, idly twirling a fry like a tiny baton in his nimble fingers. But the FBI will have plenty of time to spare for us. Cruz was in the back seat, experimenting with her power. She had become adept at disappearing. Now she was trying something very different. Reappearing, but as someone else, altering her visible self. In the rearview mirror, Malik glanced up from time to time to see a partly transparent Cruz, looking sometimes like a badly lit version of herself, and other times like other people, often celebrities. She needed photos to picture the faces she mirrored. At the moment, it was pictures of beautiful women that held Cruz's interest. Malik saw her flicking through them on her stolen phone. Her expression almost giddy with the possibilities. Great, Malik thought. And I was hoping Cruz would be the sensible one. We need a goal, an objective, Malik insisted. A plan? Shade flashed an irritated look at him, which softened quickly. Malik could all but read Shade's mind. Malik had rescued them. Malik had thrown in with them. Malik was in the same danger she and Cruz were in. Shade had heard his half of a stormy, painful call with his parents. Malik's life was coming apart, and Shade knew it was her fault. Malik thought, yeah, you damn well better be nice to me. According to Twitter, the center of all this is in California, Shade said. So that's where we're heading. And why exactly would we be heading to the center of all the problems? Malik demanded. This is all connected to the PBA. Most of the survivors are in California, Shade said. Which is not an answer, Shade. Shade shrugged. You're right. So, you have a better idea? We need to disappear for a while, Malik said. Or, Shade said, glancing back at Cruz. Oh my God, Cruz! In the rearview mirror was what looked an awful lot like a translucent Taylor Swift,
I know, Cruz cried. I've been trying to, and it kind of works. I can disappear, Cruz said, her voice heavy with awe and amazement. Then reappear looking, well, however I want.
And you went with Taylor Swift?
Shade demanded. Cruz turned her newly stolen iPhone around and showed them both a photo of Swift. It was almost entirely identical to Cruz, aside from the translucence.
I need a photo and look, this is real creepy.
She turned her head sideways, and the entire back half of her head was invisible. It was like she was wearing a Taylor Swift mask over an invisible head, like the face was floating in air.
Ah!
Malik yelped. Okay, that is amazing, Shade said. She reached to touch Cruz's face.
Amazing. It feels completely real.
The skin dimpled where Shade touched it. She could feel Cruz's body heat. She could feel her agitated breath. Shade touched the invisible back of Cruz's head, and it too felt real.
You know you just poked me in the ear, right? Cruz said.
This is insane, Malik said. This is... And then he started to laugh, his strange, barking seal laugh. The laugh that had embarrassed him all his life, but that seldom failed to elicit a grin from Shade. Shade's eyes narrowed, and just a hint of her teeth showed through a tight grimace of a smile. This gives us a whole new power.
I know!
Are you, Malik began. Then he reformulated his question.
I mean, do you think it changed, you know, other things, down there things?
Cruz, with the Swift face, patted her chest, her still male chest.
No, she said, a bit deflated. I'm still a boy, down there. I would need a visual, a picture, and La Swift does not pose naked.
Malik threw up his hands.
I don't even know how to start thinking about all this. We are way off the weirdness scale here.
My God, Malik Tenerife just admitted he doesn't understand something. I want to record that, Shade snarked.
Hero, villain, monster, right? So help me figure out how to play hero. It's our only way through all this. I realize in your comics there's constantly some big crisis, where the cops just sort of stand around helplessly, waiting for a superhero to fly in, but that isn't real life.
Is now, Malik said glumly.
Shade rolled her eyes. Okay, you know I'm going to ask you why you think that, so why not just tell me rather than dragging it out?
Nightmare, Malik said smugly, deliberately smug, to annoy Shade. He's the monster, although I strongly suspect he's really a villain.
Not according to him,
Cruz said from the back seat. You saw his tweets?
Malik waved that off impatiently. Doesn't matter. He could play the monster role all he wants, but he's left a trail of death behind him, so we could treat him as a villain.
Under the official rules of comics?
Shade drawled.
He destroyed the Golden Gate Bridge, Malik said, and made a face that said, what, that's not enough?
Definitely villain behavior,
Cruz chimed in, herself once more. They fell silent, Malik and Cruz both knowing Shade well enough to know that in the end, she'd be the one to decide.
Could I beat him in a fight?
Shade asked.
Until the other night in the cemetery, I'd never even been in any kind of fight.
Malik cast a sidelong look at Shade.
The thing is, if you're playing the hero role, you don't actually have to beat him. You just have to try, and people have to see you trying.
Then to Cruz in the rearview mirror, speaking of typical tropes, you and I are either sidekicks or enablers. I guess you're the sidekick, since you have a power.
Did you see the videos?
Shade demanded, ignoring the byplay. It was a purely rhetorical question. They'd all watched the YouTube videos repeatedly.
That's a big scary thing, that nightmare.
With your speed? Cruz asked. He'd probably never touch you.
Shade now twisted to talk to Cruz. When you morph, when you use your power, do you still always feel...
Now it was Cruz's turn to look grave.
The dark things watching?
Yes. That's why I don't change for long. I feel them, and each time it's like I can hear them a little better. Not that there's an actual sound, just...
She shrugged.
What is it? They whatever?
Shade shook her head.
I don't know.
Guess, Malik demanded. Shade was quiet for so long, Malik was sure she'd say nothing. But then,
I think of them as the Dark Watchers. I think they are the same thing that was inside that girl, Gaia.
Which tells you what?
I have to pee, Shade said.
Cut the bullshit, babe.
Shade took a deep breath.
You want a theory? I've got a theory. Everyone always thought the ASOs were benign life-creating viruses, basically. But what do real viruses do? They turn healthy cells into breeders of more virus. And sometimes they turn a healthy cell into cancer. I think somehow a consciousness is in that ASO virus, in that rock.
Eyes down, she added. I think they're using us. I think maybe we're an experiment.
Unless, Malik prompted, unless we're just entertainment.
And yet you think this is all still a great idea? Malik said, harsher than he intended.
It would help me to not think you're crazy if you'd at least admit this is all a huge mistake.
I'm going in to use the ladies.
Shade did not invite them to come with, nor did she offer to get anything while in the Target store.
We're in trouble, aren't we?
Cruz asked when Shade was gone. Malik didn't bother answering.
I don't think I should have eaten the rock, Cruz said.
Malik, with great self-discipline, resisted the urge to say and to shout and perhaps even to sing at the top of his voice that he had told her so, that he had warned them both that they were taking on a fight with all the might of the government.
I don't know what I thought would happen, Cruz said. I don't know, I just... Maybe it's all a mental illness, like my father and like half of people think. I just wanted to... Just trying to... But maybe I'm fooling myself. Maybe it really is just gender dysphoria, a mental illness. So what if it is, Cruz?
Malik cut in impatiently. He was coming to have great affection for Cruz, but her unwillingness to stand up to Shade irritated him. Half the time, she was in what Malik...